Mark chapter 15, verse 16. Jesus is mocked. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak. Twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews! And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put on his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha! You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he's calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." There were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James the younger, and of Joses, and Salome. When he was in Galilee, they followed him and ministered to him. And there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem.
I mentioned this last week, Tanya and I, just in recent days, have been doing quite a lot of life laundry, going from the top of the house right through to the bottom of the house. And it's bringing back all sorts of memories. And I've kept for quite a few years now the remnants of my biker days. I used to keep them in a wooden box that I called the Ark of the Covenant. But now Tanya keeps other things in there, and my old biker gear gets kept elsewhere. I was going to bring them in and show you all just to give you the evidence of what I really used to dress like. But I decided to leave them in the van outside. I didn't have the bottle at the last minute. But I remember when I was... I had great, great years. I could spend a lot of time tonight telling you all about my various motorbikes. And I'd love to do that, but you probably wouldn't like to hear it. So we'll save that for another occasion. But when I was... I left school at 16. I went off to a tech college to do an engineering diploma. Most of the guys that were on the course with me, most of my friends, were motorcyclists. And some of them were pretty nutty, actually. A guy called Paul Frampton, a good mate of mine, he bought himself, back in 1980, 81, he bought a Yamaha RD250, which is a very, very fast motorcycle. It was actually a racing bike. It was crashed on Brands Hatch, and he bought it and rebuilt the thing. And would bring bits into lectures each day. He didn't listen to any lectures, but he'd be at the back of the class, sort of polishing up a piston head, or bringing in the leather seat and doing a bit of sewing. And each year on our course there at Guildford Tech, our lecturers and the guys running the course would get in the local motor police motorcyclist to give us the whole day, basically, on motorcycle safety. And he would come in and he would frighten us, seriously frighten us, with horrendous stories. He would freak us out with slides, with photographs, and if it'd be nowadays, a PowerPoint presentation with real photographs of motorcycles that had come off and crashed, and they would describe in great detail what had happened to the biker. It really sort of tidied up our biking skills for a while, and then we all started slipping back a little bit. But, he would say, I'll never forget some of the things he said. I won't tell you the story about why we ought to wear our crash helmets, but that story remains very clearly in my mind. Wear your skid lid. We were told to make sure that we always wore our leather jackets, even if it was a hot, sunny summer day. And he told us about a guy who loved Jane. And Jane was his girlfriend, and he had "I love Jane" tattooed across his chest. Well, he came off his motorbike, he wasn't wearing his leathers, and all that was left was I and E. Sticks in my mind, you know, yeah, I always wear my leather jacket. And always wear your motorbike boots. You know, he told about one guy who decided to overtake a car, and there was the gap was closing rather rapidly with a big scammel truck coming the other way. He made the gap, but then after a few seconds realized actually his foot was on the front of the scammel truck still traveling the other direction. So wear your boots. At least it might keep the thing linked to you and somebody would sew it back on. So the story still remained in my mind, and I've just been reflecting on the talk tonight. Jesus' words are our warnings. And can I just pick up that motorcycle lecture that we had, or day we had each year? Did that guy come in just to kind of spoil our fun? Or did he actually come through to actually warn us about some serious issues that we needed to hear about because in actual fact he cared? Did our lecturers do it just to kind of like give us a bit of morbid fascination for a day? Or in actual fact, did they care about us? Was there something really to be concerned about? Well, there was. We were idiots, really. And we needed to know. And it was really out of kindness that they did that each year for us. And Jesus' words are also very serious warnings indeed. Jesus said things there. He warned us about our sin. He warned us about hell and about judgment. Not just to spoil our fun or not to spoil our fun. No, because he cares. He warns us for a real reason. And last Sunday and earlier this evening with what Kim shared, we saw that according to Jesus, each of us has that serious problem in our hearts. Keep your place there in Mark 16 and just turn back to Mark chapter 7. And one of the things that we were thinking about last week, Jesus says in Mark chapter 7, verse 20, he said this, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of a man and of a woman, come evil thoughts and all the rest of it." From within, we have a problem within our hearts. And this means that we are in danger. And ultimately, our sin, as we were thinking about last week, will lead us to hell. But the great news, the wonderful news of Christianity, of Jesus, is basically, he said that I came not to call the righteous, but to call sinners. You remember the religious leaders of the day were uptight with him because he was having parties and basically down the pub with all the local sinners. And they were uptight. Well, Jesus said, I didn't come to call righteous people. I came for sinful people. And he says that he came to rescue us. Well, how did he rescue sinful people? Well, that's what we're coming through tonight. And it's just striking how throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus keeps on talking about his death. keeps on taking, Mark, as he tells us about Jesus, keeps on taking us to that. If you're scrolling down a few notes, then chapter 8 and verse 31, but turn on from chapter 7 through to chapter 10, and look with me at verse 45. Jesus speaks himself, he calls himself the Son of Man, basically the Messiah. For even the Son of Man, the Messiah himself, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came to give his life, to pay a ransom for us, for sinful people. And each time that Jesus talked about his own death, it made his friends, those first disciples, a little bit jittery. It made them very, very uncomfortable. It unnerved them, understandably so. And it's just striking as well how we read all of the Gospels. I've said this before as we've been looking at Mark's Gospel, but it's true for Mark's Gospel, it's true for each of the Gospels. They spend about a third of the biography of Jesus, not on his life, but on his death, on the last week of his life. And concentrating so much upon Jesus' suffering and on his death by crucifixion. We read most biographies, and they spend perhaps not very much time at all, or space at all, on the death of the individual they're writing about. But Jesus, a whole whopping great big chunk of the biography is about his death. His death by crucifixion. And it's just striking, I mean, Mark's Gospel is highly likely it was written for people in Rome. And the Romans, they'd invented this crucifixion business. And crucifixion was considered to be terribly shameful. It's striking that Mark spends such a long time talking about crucifixion. It was a shameful thing. It was against Roman law for a Roman citizen to be sentenced to be crucified. It was a terrible way to die. You know, the crucifixion was reserved to rebels out there in the colonies. And it was deliberately cruel. It was gruesome. It was terrible. And in one sense, it was the ultimate deterrent against rebellion. You know, you don't want to rebel because that'll be what happens to you. The big question is, why has something which was so terrible, so horrendous, so horrific, actually become the symbol of Christianity? People, we do, don't we? Go around with crosses around our necks. It's a bit like going around with a tombstone or with an electric chair or something around our necks. And people go, oh, isn't that pretty? Got nice diamonds on it. Cruel killing machine, the cross. Now, why? Why is it it's become the symbol of Christianity? Well, the answer is the cross is so important because Jesus' death is the only way we could be saved from our sin. Kim mentioned that we needed a rescue from outside of ourselves. And that's how Jesus came to rescue rebels. And to understand what that means, then we do need to look a little bit more closely at the reading that Sheila read for us in Mark chapter 15. So turn on to Mark 15, where we were at the start. We learn three striking things here about Jesus' death. But number one, God was angry. When Jesus died on the cross, we are told basically that God was angry. In fact, we read the lines between the lines. God was livid, very angry indeed. Now look at verse 33. This is where it really picks up God's anger. Verse 33, and when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. Mark is basically counting the hours, the time, according to the Jewish system. The Jewish system then. And the sixth hour was basically midday. And so you can imagine it. Midday comes, and it's the moment of the day when the sun is right at the peak of its curve across the world there. This is nearer the equator, so it kind of probably is somewhere in the middle, not like we have it at midday in England at the moment. It's kind of like a little blip on the horizon, but it's there, up there, and it's shining bright. It should have been in the middle of the sky, at its hottest, midday, but no. Well, as Jesus hangs on the cross, everything at that moment goes dark. At the brightest moment of the day, darkness falls upon the whole land for 3 hours till 3 o'clock. It couldn't have been an eclipse. Eclipses don't last 3 hours. It couldn't have been an eclipse because Passover, always this was happening at Passover, Jewish Passover time, and Passover always happened at full moon time. And we'll ask any astronomer, full moon time, the Earth and the Moon and the Sun are in all the wrong positions, or in fact directly the opposite positions, for there to be an eclipse. So Mark is telling us that something supernatural was happening. Time and time again throughout the Bible, we understand that light is about God's presence, and darkness is about God's absence, or God's anger, or God's wrath, God's judgment. And so what's being depicted here in Mark's Gospel is a moment of God's anger, a moment of judgment. And don't get me wrong, I mean, God's not stroppy. He don't kind of fly off the handle. He's consistent. He's really only angry at one thing, rebellion against him. Understandably so. And we think about our world and what we as human beings have done to it. I mean, it's good to know that God is not relaxed about sin. It's great to know that God is not relaxed about lying and about hatred and about selfishness. It's good to know that he cares about these things. He cares enough to get angry about them. I remember hearing a story once about a whole bunch of boys that were out in the street causing absolute mayhem, fighting and really causing a whole load of aggro in the neighbourhood. And one by one, loads of dads came out and grabbed their boy, took him home, and gave them probably each of them a great hiding. There's one kid left who ends up crying. And one of the dads notices through the window, there's one kid left in the street crying. And he goes out and he said to him, you know, why are you crying? And his kid realized that no one cared enough for him to get angry and come and grab him off the street. Everyone else had a dad that seemed to care. And that's I thank God that he cares. And his care drives him to anger. And his anger is depicted here. It's happening here at the cross. God's angry with sin. But whose sin does he punish at this moment on the cross? See, the staggering answer is that God seems to be angry with Jesus. With Jesus. And as we read Mark's Gospel, we read the other Gospels, we read a couple of moments when there's a moment when God the Father speaks from heaven, like at the baptism of Jesus. He speaks from heaven and he says, "This is my Son whom I love. This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." And suddenly, God's angry with him on the cross. That's the first point. God's angry. The second point is this. Jesus was abandoned. Verse 34. And at the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? My God, why have you forsaken me? There's no doubt at all that Jesus was suffering physical pain, agony on the cross, but those words are actually really spoken out of spiritual agony. It's striking as we read the story of what's going on the cross, this is an eyewitness account, but in actual fact it turns to ear witness. You can tell actually it's probably dark. From this point on, you hear what's going on. You hear the cry from the cross. You hear the conversations at the foot of the cross. It's dark. And this cry is one of spiritual agony, being forsaken by God. My God, why have you forsaken me? On the cross, Jesus was abandoned by God the Father. Jesus was punished. Yeah, but Jesus had led a sinless life. And not even his fiercest enemies could find a fault in him. Not even Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate actually says, he's innocent. The Roman governor who sentenced him ultimately to die, Pontius. So why should God be punishing him? Why should God be punishing Jesus? Why did Jesus allow himself to be subjected to this? Well, let me use this little book that I used last week, this book called Perfectionism, basically because none of us are perfect, which is the reason why I use this book. Although the author, B.B. Walfer, is a great, great author. He's a good guy. Just a thing that we were saying last week, that this book, let's just say tonight, represents a record of your life or my life. In it is recorded every thought we've ever thought, everything we've ever said or done, and of course as well all those things we should have said that we didn't do, and all those things we shouldn't have thought that we did do. And as we read through it, I've got it upside down there. As we read through it, there'd be plenty of good things if it was the story of my life. Some really exciting things, but in actual fact, because there are so many things that I'm ashamed of, I wouldn't want you having the book at all. I would want to make sure it's kept very, very firmly sealed, and I wouldn't let it out of my sight. I wouldn't want anyone reading this book if it was the story of my life, and I'm sure if it was the story of your life, you wouldn't want anyone, you wouldn't want me reading it, reading about your life. There's plenty that we're ashamed of. And the Bible actually says that no creature is hidden from God's sight. It's Hebrews 4, verse 13. That no creature is hidden from God's sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. See, God reads the book. God knows exactly what's in that book. He sees every thought of our mind and all of our actions. Well, let's just suppose that my left hand there is me, and the ceiling represents God. Well, basically, the Bible says that my sin, my rebellion, comes between me and God. So that actually, in reality, I am forsaken by him. I can't have that relationship with God that I was made for, I was created with. I'm separated from him, cut off from God. But that helps pick up what's happening at the cross as Jesus dies on the cross. See, let's just say that my right hand is Jesus, and the ceiling is still God the Father. Between Jesus and God the Father, there was no barrier. He lived a perfect life. He is the one of whom the Father said, "This is my Son, in whom I'm well pleased." He actually said, "This is my Son, listen to him." And yet Jesus, as he's on the cross there, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" See, he was forsaken. But it wasn't his sin that separated him from God. No, it was the sin of all who would trust him and trust his death to be for them. It was my sin that separated Jesus from God. If I trust Jesus for my sin, to have died for my sin, then he takes that upon himself. And that's why he's abandoned by God. So if God had answered him, the Father had answered him from heaven, Jesus Christ, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the Father answered, remember, well, he would have said, well, actually, for Tim Davis and for Bill Fernahuff and for Paul Robinson. At that moment, Jesus was taking on himself all the punishment everything in my book and your book deserves. And the Bible says, we all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Jesus died as my substitute in my place, taking the punishment that I deserve. So what happens here? So me, this is my left hand, is me again, so that I can actually have that relationship with God again. The way is open. No longer abandoned by him. No longer forsaken by him. Striking, isn't it? It's wonderful. A friend called David. David has actually died a few years ago. Well, I first met him basically because he got cancer. He was an atheist, a strongly passionate atheist, and he got cancer. He was encouraged by somebody to give me a ring, so he did. I went round to his place, and in our first conversation, we sat there in his living room, and he broke up into tears. This is a guy who was an architect and a businessman who'd done really well. He broke into tears in his living room, and he said to me, "Tim, I now know what Jesus felt like, and I know what he meant when he said, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" And he said it with some bitterness, venom, kind of came through. And I gave him a copy of Mark's Gospel, it was a number of years ago, and I said, "Look, David, would you just read through Mark's Gospel with me? Just read a little section at a time, and I'll come back each week, and we'll, you know." He had the death sentence, basically, from the doctors. And said, "Look, just for these last months of your life, let's read Mark's Gospel." He didn't ask me any question. We read through Mark's Gospel, and we got to Jesus' death on the cross. And he said to me, "Tim, now I know, I really know why Jesus said those words. And Jesus said those words, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' so that I need never say those words." And David was converted. And the village was shocked, because they knew that he was a hardened atheist. And a few weeks later he died. I believe he went to glory, to heaven. God was angry. Jesus was abandoned for us. Thirdly, we can be accepted. Verses 37 and 38 really pick up this in the imagery in what happens on the other side of the city. Jesus dying on one side of the city on the cross, and then something happens at the other side of the city within the temple, the place where the Jews would meet to worship God. Verse 37, Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. He died. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And basically what's going on there is the temple was divided into two, it was divided into three sections, but there were two in particular. Behind a vast great big curtain, and behind that was called the Holy of Holies, where God was said to dwell and be. And the people, God's people, could gather in the one section, but they could not go through this curtain. It was like a great big no entry sign. It was really like the book on my hand. You are separate. You can't come into the presence of a holy God. You're out there, God's in here. You can't mess about with him. You're sinful and he's holy. As Jesus dies on the cross, that curtain, which apparently was very, very thick indeed, was just torn to shreds, top to bottom. It's magnificent and very, very significant indeed. It was 32 foot high, ripped apart. Basically, the no entry sign is gone, and God is saying, the way is open for people to come into my presence again. No longer to be abandoned, no longer to be judged, because Jesus was judged instead. Jesus dies on the cross, and God rips open that curtain and opens the way through to himself. Well, those are the main things that we learn about the cross, so what was going on. God was angry. He was angry with Jesus, because Jesus took upon himself the sin and the punishment for our sin. So Jesus was abandoned in order that we might be accepted. Now, I wonder how we respond. There are a number of reactions, and we'll just look through them briefly as we come to a close. A number of reactions are happening around. Mark tells us about a number of reactions to Jesus' death upon the cross. First of all, there were the busy soldiers. They were the ones who crucified Jesus. Look at verse 24. They crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. I mean, basically, these guys are just doing their job. They're busy, going about doing what they're paid to do. And because they're just getting on with doing their duty, they miss the whole significance of the cross. I wonder, would that be true for you? Be sad, wouldn't it? To go through life, to work hard, to do our career, to plan our homes, to do our family, to get on well with our studies, to be busy, 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 and to miss out on what the cross means for us. Some people will do that. Some people still do that. Secondly, there are the self-satisfied religious leaders, verses 31 to 32. So the chief priests with the scribes mocked Jesus to one another, saying, He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe. Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. See, they mock Jesus, convinced that they know that they are okay with God. Their religion will do them absolutely fine. They're pretty sure of that. And their religion has got nothing to do with Jesus Christ and the cross. Well, that's irrelevant to it. They are basically, fundamentally self-righteous. Hey, you know, I don't need Jesus to die for me. Yeah, there are plenty around still like that, who think that they're okay before God and think that they don't really need Jesus to have died for them. There's the cowardly Pontius Pilate as well. I've already mentioned him. Pilate knew Jesus was innocent, and Mark tells us that very clearly indeed. He handed Jesus over to the cross basically because he was a coward. He was frightened of riots and frightened of that getting back to the big bosses in Rome, that he couldn't keep a handle on things in this little country in Palestine. So he hands him over. Verse 15. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, not justice, released for them Barabbas, who was a rebel, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Basically, Pilate, he's the ultimate crowd pleaser, isn't he? He succumbs to peer pressure. And there are plenty as well that would do that, aren't there? So fearful of what others might say. You know, when we let them know that we follow Jesus, that we just keep it quiet, or we actually decide not to follow him because we feel the cost would be too high. My friends will despise me, they'll reject me, they won't want to be my mates anymore, and all the rest of it. There'll be people perhaps here tonight who may not follow Jesus for this reason. There's also the detached bystander, verse 36. Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. Just someone just speculating, you know, Elijah was in Jewish myth, legend was, well, he was a prophet in reality in history, but it became known in legend as someone who could perhaps help people when they were in moments of need. It seems to me that what's going on here is just simply a bunch of rubberneckers who are there to see what's going on, and just out of a bit of morbid interest. See what happens, see if Elijah does respond, eh? They're really unmoved by the whole thing. There are plenty of people who are unmoved by Jesus' death on the cross. They know about the cross, but they really don't think it will affect them personally, or it ought to. I wonder how do we react? How do you react? Like the busy soldiers? Self-satisfied religious leaders? The cowardly Pontius Pilate? Or the detached bystander? Of course, there is another reaction, isn't there? The fifth reaction, the Roman centurion, who recognizes that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, this is a hard-bitten Roman soldier. He was high-ranking, a centurion, doubtless he had fought many campaigns, doubtless he had seen plenty of people die, doubtless he had killed plenty of people. Perhaps there were plenty by crucifixion. Perhaps he was pretty good at doing the crucifixions. But he'd never seen anyone die like Jesus. And so this hard-bitten soldier, this enemy of Israel, he's the one who sums the whole thing up there in verse 39. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." This guy confesses as as his Messiah, as his King, a dying Christ, dying Jesus. A fifth response. I wonder how we'd respond tonight. That's the final option there, the centurion, who basically would trust himself, his life, to the Son of God, as he breathed his last. I pray as well that would be the response for each of us here this evening. Let's just take a moment to reflect, shall we? and just search through our own hearts and our own minds, our own consciences. Probably a good thing to do that every so often, just to pause and reflect and just to, in our own minds, think things through. Which of the reactions to Jesus' death on the cross do you identify with? Life too busy? Think you're okay with God without the cross of Jesus? You're afraid of what others might think of you? Jesus died on the cross and, well, don't really care that much, doesn't really affect me. Or is it like the Roman centurion, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, died for me? It's good to do that just in life a moment, just to just take a moment, just to be quiet and to pause and to reflect and think. I hope you found that helpful. Next question really is, what are you going to do with your thoughts? And where are you going to take them from here? I'd be good to discuss things with a friend or someone you came with this evening. A number do regularly every week from after our meeting, head across to the Utopia coffee bar at the bottom of West One. Might be good to join with others and chat things through further over there. We have some little response forms as well. I want to find out more about what Christians believe. I have some questions that would like to talk someone through. I'm already a Christian, would like to join Christ Church Central. I have other comments, questions. These little feedback forms, they're on the desk over there by that door. You might want to just find that as a convenient way for you to respond. And let me have it, or Bill, or drop it into Edgerton Hall, post it to Edgerton Hall where our headquarters are. That may be a way for you to react this evening. Well, let's sing, shall we? Jesus died on the cross, but we'll be thinking about in a couple of weeks' time, Jesus rising again. Between now and then, next week, we're going to carry on thinking a little bit more about ourselves and Jesus, what he did for us on the cross. And we're